It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back Monday. Coming up later in the program, we'll check in with a political scientist about what we can expect from our federal and state government in 2014. First, it's the time of year when the nights are long. It's perfect for stargazing as long as it's not too cold out there. But just how much of the sky are we really seeing? Back in July, we spoke to Paul Bogard. He's the author of The End of Night, Searching for Darkness in the Age of Artificial Light. Paul's worried about light pollution, that it is blocking out the darkness and it's hampering our enjoyment of the night sky, but also having some serious consequences of our health and well-being. And while lights can be a sign of hustle and bustle, I began the interview by asking him what all these lights are costing us.
Well, they are kind of exciting, and one of the things I say again and again in the book is that light itself is not the problem. Light is wonderful. It's light at night. It's a miracle, but we're using so much of it now, much more than we really need to, and it's costing us in many ways. We're wasting a whole lot of energy and money, for one thing. We're losing or have lost a view of the stars, of the heavens, and it's impacting our physical, mental, and spiritual health and the health of the environment that we depend on.
So you've been watching this and tracking this for your book. What is the evidence out there that darkness is going away?
Well, the simple evidence is just to walk out your front door and look and see what you see, which probably is a lot of light, and a lot of light that's shining straight into your eyes because it's coming from fixtures that are unshielded, and so they're casting glare. Or to look up at the sky and notice that you're hardly seeing any stars at all if you're living in Western city, in Western Europe or North America. And so there's that first-hand evidence, but then there's also evidence that astronomers have come up with that show the true spread of artificial light at night in such that it covers the whole east of the Mississippi now. There's really no place that we could say is untouched by artificial light.
East of the Mississippi, there's no place that's untouched, really.
That's what they say, and of course, I'm not talking about dark places like down in the basement or something like that. And on a cloudy night out in the woods, it's going to be pretty darn dark. But on a clear night, if you're just going out to look at the stars in your backyard, you're not seeing a natural night sky.
Is there a way to measure just how dark it is? How much light pollution there is, in other words?
Well, there are some ways. There are meters that folks use to gauge the light in the sky. But one of the most useful gauges that I've found is called the Bortle scale. This was a scale of darkness that was developed by an amateur astronomer in northern upstate New York. And he ranked levels of darkness from 9 down to 1, 9 being our brightest places and 1 being our darkest places. And so I borrowed the idea of the scale from my table of contents, and I have 9 chapters, and I start in chapter 9 and work my way down to chapter 1. So I start the book in Las Vegas, end up in some real dark places. And one of the things that really stands out to me about this, this scale of darkness is that most Americans live most of their lives in the levels of about 5 and up, so 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Most of us just only rarely or even never experience darkness that would be in those levels of 4, 3, 2, and certainly 1.
Well, what about you? Did you find some of those darkest places?
I did. I had some really wonderful experiences, again, mostly out west, and especially in some of the national parks. The National Park Service now has a night sky team that's going around and measuring levels of darkness, and the National Park Service is now seeing the preservation of darkness in the parks as part of their mission, which I think is really pretty wonderful.
So for a lot of us, you know, maybe there's this innate primate thing that if things get too dark, we get kind of scared. So what is it that you find so, you know, wonderful and mysterious about these dark places?
Well, I have to admit, first off, that I'm one of those people who gets a little afraid of the dark. It's I know it's a little ironic. The guy that wrote the book about darkness would admit to being a little afraid of the dark. But I think that's totally natural. I think that's part of being human. But you know, what is also and has always been part of the human experience is this experience of walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe. And we've really more or less lost that experience, and it impacts us in ways that I think a lot of folks haven't really spent much time thinking about. So, you know, for generations and generations, this experience of walking out at night and seeing a real night sky has inspired artwork, certainly. It's inspired religion, wonder, awe, and a real sense of our place, not only in the universe, but our place here on Earth. You know, coming face to face with all those stars can make you feel pretty small, but I think for me, it also makes me feel large in the sense of understanding how wonderful and beautiful this world is, and how important it is that our role is in taking care of this world.
Now, you and I chatted by phone a couple of weeks ago, and you told me that you'd spent some time in Wisconsin and up on Madeline Island, which is one of my favorite places to be and where I've seen incredible night skies, at least to my mind. How does Madeline Island shape up in the darkness meter for you?
Madeline is probably going to be right in that three level, I would say. I was really lucky to spend 3 years teaching up at Northland College in Ashland. And I remember in my job interview, the committee was extolling the virtues of the darkness in that area as a way of enticing me to come up and work there. So, yeah, I mean, there are real beautiful areas of darkness left in Wisconsin. And if you go across the border to the Boundary Waters in Minnesota, you can find some real beautiful darkness. But just everywhere is feeling the impact of artificial light. I grew up in Minneapolis, and my family has a cabin in northern Minnesota. So when I was a kid, we had real darkness. We had probably what would rank about a 3 or even a 2 on that Bortle scale I was talking about, where you'd stand on the end of the dock and watch satellites pass through these just sugary spreads of stars, just amazing numbers of stars. And, you know, I go back there now and it's still dark and it's still beautiful, but I can tell it's not the same. I can tell there's light on the horizon and light in the sky from the surrounding towns.
Wow. Sugary spreads of stars. Now, that's something everybody's got to want to see. I know. I mean, how do you know if you're seeing, you know, because most of us can look up and say, yeah, there's a few stars, but how can we tell when we're really not seeing the full view?
Well, I talked to a number of astronomers, mostly, and dark sky advocates who gave me a few rubrics for that. I remember Bob Berman, an astronomy writer in upstate New York, who said, he really thinks it takes about 450 individual stars for us to have that experience of kind of, wow, like this is something amazing. To put that in perspective, in many American and really cities all over the world, you walk out at night, you're probably lucky to see about 25 individual stars. The human eye, which is really, I don't know if people understand how remarkable the eye is in terms of seeing at night. On a normal natural night, we ought to be able to see about 2,500 individual stars. So again, Berman put this number at about 450 as the moment when you're kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, this is amazing.
That's the wow number.
Yeah, that is the wow number, at least for him. And I would just say a lot of folks would just say, if you can see the Milky Way arcing overhead, that's when you're going to be filled with wonder and kind of realize what you're missing the rest of your life.
That's Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night. We've got the second half of the interview coming up in just a few moments. We're talking darkness this hour and the way that our modern brightly lit lifestyle is threatening our view of the sky and our health. Our guest is Paul Bogard, the author of The End of Night. And Paul, before we get to the health stuff, let's take a call next. We have Monica in Greenfield. Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call and for this program. I feel very strongly about the need of having darkness at night, but the reason for when we sleep. But the reason for my call is because this program reminds me of the darkest place that I have been at, which is my hometown. I grew up in central Mexico, right between Mexico City and the border with the United States. Mm. And the second time I went back home, this place is a mile and a half above the level of the sea. And growing up, people used to tell me that Zacatecas, my hometown, had the darkest blue sky ever. Well, this day that I came back home, it was in the middle of the night. It was probably around 2 in the morning. And I came out of the plane and into the open airport, and I looked up at the sky, and I started crying and weeping because I really got that feeling that this is so beautiful. And we used to see the Milky Way from there.
You describe it beautifully. Paul, have you been in that area?
I haven't, actually, but hearing that, I would love to go.
Thank you so much for that call. We appreciate that. And another one from Anne. Anne is calling from Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi there, Anne.
Hi. I lived in California for about 11 years, between 91 and 2002. And I used to go camping and go to different places. And at some point, I went to the Death Valley Desert. And I believe that's where it was that at night, when I looked up and I saw how many stars could be seen, how many stars were in sky, I couldn't believe that I had lived this long and never known that I could, that could be seen. And I believe it was the Death Valley Desert. I went to a lot of places. But I wonder, aren't there must still be places in the West where you can go and see that.
Well, you described that wonderfully, too. I've never been there, but I think, Paul, that you've been out that way.
I have, actually. I'm smiling as I'm hearing your guest, your caller, talk about Death Valley, because I had one of the most wonderful experiences during my research, that, and it made it into the book, of being in Death Valley. Just a phenomenal place at night. And one of the things I think about when I think of Death Valley is, you know, our eyes, as I mentioned earlier, are really quite amazing in terms of their ability to see at night, but you have to give them time. And so I had the experience of being out at night for about 10 minutes and seeing a difference, and then maybe about 45 minutes and seeing a difference. But I tell you, after about 3 hours in Death Valley, it was almost like if you've ever gone to the eye doctor and he's trying or she's trying to get the your prescription right, and they're kind of saying, is that better, is that better, is that better, and all of a sudden they strike that one where everything is crystal clear. It's almost like after 3 hours the sky just developed in front of my eyes, and I felt like I was seeing stars that I hadn't seen before, and that was pretty amazing.
That does sound amazing. And that was in Death Valley, you said.
In Death Valley, which is, again, you know, obviously a national park, a place that you can relatively easily get to. I should say also that this night in Death Valley, as wonderful as it was, I could also see on the horizon the glow of Las Vegas. And so there even wouldn't be considered, as we were talking about earlier, a class one darkness, because that class one would be no evidence of artificial light.
Las Vegas, the brightest place. Paul, what are you doing there?
I don't know. It's it's a little ironic. I know that. So,
okay, let's take in one more call. Doug in Perry. Hi, Doug.
Hi, I'm calling from the town of Perry in Dane County, Wisconsin. And just like to let you know that here in the town, if you sit in a lawn chair at night and look up, we can easily count over 1,000 stars right off the bat, see the Milky Way, and watch the International Space Station going by, even though we're only a few minutes from the capital in Wisconsin here. And one of the reasons is, and this is the reason for my call, is in our town we passed a dark sky ordinance. And that ordinance requires people to have shielded lights on outdoor lights, particularly dusk to dawn lights. And if you have an old light that stops working or finally fails or whatever, the new one that you replace it with has to be shielded. And if anyone wants to try their hand at getting an ordinance passed like that in their town, they can just come to the Town of Perry website. You can just look it up on the web and scroll down to ordinances, and you'll see the dark sky ordinance right there.
All right, interesting. Thank you so much for bringing that up, Doug. And Paul, can you speak to that? Is that a growing trend, these dark sky ordinances, which is, I'm assuming are efforts to lid the lights at night?
Yeah, what a great call. It's really wonderful to hear that. Another place you can go if you're interested is the International Dark Sky Association. That's darksky.org. They can give you a lot of information about these lighting ordinances. And you know, listening to that call reminds me of something I come back to a lot in the book and when I'm talking with folks about this, which is, you know, this is a problem, I'm speaking of light pollution, that we can readily address. It's not to say that it's simple or that it'll just be overnight, right? But it is something that we can tackle. And that gives me a real sense of hope and purpose. Not that I'm not dealing with some of these other huge problems that are so important to our world, but light pollution is something that we can do something about.
Now, I want to get to some of the health costs of darkness. Now, there's the wonder factor, which we've been hearing about, and you know, you could just look at that alone, and that would be enough, I think, to make people care. But there are also health costs associated with the lack of darkness, aren't there?
There are, and I think you know, it was important for me in the book to make sure that it's not just a book of astronomy. It's not just a book about the night sky. It really is a book about how important night is and how important darkness is. And one of the reasons, one of the real important reasons that darkness is vital is that we need it for health, for our physical, mental, spiritual health. And just a way to think about it is just that all life on Earth evolved in bright days and dark nights, and we need both for optimal health. So the effect on the human body, you know, our body has never evolved to adjust to all the light that we have in the night right now. And so this is a completely unnatural experience. And what we're doing now is kind of an enormous ongoing experiment. We're just beginning to get some of the results from. And what we're finding is that all this light at night is disrupting our sleep. It's confusing our body's circadian rhythms, and it's impeding the production of the hormone melatonin, and this has been linked to the development of cancer in our bodies. So much so that the World Health Organization now classifies night shift work as a probable carcinogen. Mm-hmm. And with 20% of Americans and Europeans working at night, part of the time at least, this is becoming a real problem.
So does that mean we should do what we can? If we can't have total darkness in our cities, we should be buying light-blocking shades and things like that?
Yeah, and you know, again, the science is just emerging on this. But one of the crucial things researchers are trying to find out now is just how much light affects us. So, you know, is light coming in from a streetlight enough? Is light coming in under your bedroom door enough to cause some of these problems? Really, you know, what's one of the earlier callers spoke to this, but we can do so much to move in the right direction, both for bringing back the night sky and for protecting our health by shielding our lights and not letting all that light just kind of spray all over the place.
And how hard is that to do in your experience as cities? You know, we heard from our caller there in Perry, Wisconsin. How hard is it to get the city on board with things like this?
Well, I won't, you know, lie and say it's simple or easy, but there have been a number of towns and cities, both in the U.S. and Europe, that have had good success with that. Much of the time, it has more to do with energy costs. When folks start to realize how much money, light, energy we're wasting, and how much less light you can use when you shield these lights, or even turn the lights off part of the night. That seems to be the real motivator for a lot of places to have some of these dark sky ordinances.
And what about our obsession with our, you know, our electronic gadgets, our iPads and our iPhones? A lot of people wind down now by watching a screen, a TV or an iPad. Is that interfering, do you think?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think researchers are really trying to focus on because of the ubiquitous nature of those screens. And the thing about those screens is that they produce a blue light, which has been shown to kind of affect our bodies the most. If you think about how we evolved, our body evolved to respond to blue light, that is to wake up when the sky is blue, when that light came out. And so if you think about, you know, you're lying in bed reading on your iPad or looking at your computer or watching television, that light is telling your body to wake up. And so that's, you know, obviously kind of the opposite direction of what we're going to want our bodies to be doing when we go to sleep.
Well, Paul, it's been so wonderful to talk to you about this. Thank you for helping us think about the night sky and the stars again.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. Happy New Year. Well, we all have aspirations for 2014. Some of us make resolutions. Others of us set goals. It's a fresh start, even for institutions like Congress and the Wisconsin State Legislature. On this first day of 2014, we thought we'd check in with the political scientists about what we might expect from our federal and state government this year, what stories we should look for, and his predictions for the biggest issues in the coming year. Tim Dale is with us. He's an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's zoom in on Congress. What big stories do you see coming out of Congress in 2014?
Well, Congress is following up on a tumultuous year with the government shutdown, divided government that a lot of us were following in the past year. I think a lot of people will be watching Congress to see how the two parties work together. And there's also the question about how the Republican Party might come together. There's actually as much division within the Republican Party right now as there is between the Republicans and the Democrats. And so I think there's going to be some soul searching to figure out the direction of the party. And we'll be watching pretty closely the House of Representatives to see how that alignment might take place.
And I'm assuming that just about everyone would like to see Congress playing nicely, working better together. What do you think will decide whether or not it actually happens?
Well, and that's actually a really interesting part of the way that our Congress works, is that as much as everyone says they want Congress to play nice together and work together, the members of Congress serve districts where they're the only representative from that district. And when they go back to their district, the people in the district tell them that they want them to fight for what they elect them to fight for. So as much as in general we want Congress to work together, specifically when members run for election, they promise that they will fight for certain things. And that fight means that there is usually some sort of fight in Congress. And so the only way that Congress will actually work together is if they perceive constituents demanding that they work together. So if members go back to their districts and hear from people that they want them to work for compromise as opposed to stand for certain things or for certain principles in an uncompromising way, then I think that will really be the only realistic way that we would get Congress with an air of cooperation.
So it sounds like there's built-in contradictions there, whether we want a scrappy representation or whether we actually seriously do want compromise.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And even in the idea of compromise is something that is appealing to people. But then when they're asked about issues that they care about, they tend to say that they want a representative who's uncompromising on those issues. And the problem is that if you get enough people who elect a representative with enough issues that they want to be uncompromising about, then as much as we might like the idea of compromise, we really actually don't elect representatives with the mindset that they will be compromising. So it really is a contradiction that's built into why we see Congress functioning the way it does most of the time.
Well, on another note, we have a midterm election coming up in November. How do you think the election will affect national politics in the coming year?
Yeah, that is going to be something that we'll be watching very closely. The 2014 midterm election will be all of the members of the House of Representatives will be up for re-election. One-third of the Senate will be up for re-election. And there's even a chance that we may get a new Speaker of the House elected, either if the Democrats take over or if the Republicans stay in power. John Boehner may be done as Speaker. And so I think that the direction of the parties will be affected. And as we've seen this past year, the House of Representatives has quite a bit of power when it comes to the funding of government and the working of government. And so I think that we will see some really important developments in the coming year in terms of how Congress is going to be composed and then what Congress will be doing. And we're going to be hearing from the representatives as they run for election or reelection in terms of the vision that they have for Congress.
So you think there's a chance for a major shakeup in the composition of Congress?
There's a chance, but even as Congress has record-breaking low approval ratings, the individual members of Congress back in their districts enjoy a pretty high approval rating. So this is one of the contradictions with the way that we elect our national government, is that even if Congress has an 8 or 9% approval rating, what really matters in the number to look at is the approval rating of individual members in their districts. And so as long as individual members in their districts are enjoying a 50% or higher approval rating, as much as people hate Congress, it really wouldn't make as much difference. The chance that there is a shakeup, though, is if people have been really disgusted with their particular members of Congress. So there aren't a lot of opinion polls that are out right now, and as we get closer to the election, this will be something to watch to see if people are really upset at their own members for their lack of compromise or inability to work together, as opposed to just being overall disgruntled with what Congress and the national government is doing.
Do you think it could be that the midterms end up being more of a referendum on the Affordable Care Act than anything else?
It could be. I think that the Affordable Care Act is going to be an important part of the debate. And I think for Democrats, there's going to be, particularly for the Obama administration, a real effort to try to get some of the problems cleaned up and the public perception improved on that. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think one of the things that we haven't heard people talk about as much or complain about as much recently is when people complain sometimes that there isn't a difference between the two major political parties. I think right now in this moment of history, we see a real difference between the two political parties, and in particular what each's view of government should be or what government should do. And I think the Affordable Care Act is representative of the view of government that Democrats take, and I think Republicans have a real difference with that. So at the heart of this is going to be a referendum on the Affordable Care Act, but it'll also be an overall discussion about the direction of where government should go and what the responsibility of government should be.
Now, you said there was some schism within the Republican Party itself, and that one of the things that you'd be watching for was how that would play out down the line. And I guess I'm wondering, do you think that 2014 will be a year of soul searching for the Republican Party? Now, that's exactly what people said the last time around when there was a major presidential race as well. But do you see that continuing to evolve as we move along?
I think it's continuing to evolve. I think we've seen some new players on the stage with Senator Ted Cruz. I think that there are going to be Republicans who are making it increasingly clear that they're interested in running for president. And I think the recent government shutdown, we had a very public kind of struggle within the Republican Party about whether or not there should be some sort of compromise or whether or not there's a willingness to even have government shut down in order to stand for certain principles. So I think that's really where the soul searching will be, is the Republican Party doesn't want to be a big tent party where as many people as possible could come in and be interested in compromise. Or do they think that they can win elections, sticking with principles, being the party of less government, even to the point of willingness to have government shut down?
What about the area of being centrist versus, moving farther in one direction or the other?
Yeah, that definitely has something to do with it. Whenever there's a national election, particularly when it comes to a presidential election, the party that's the most successful is typically the party that appeals to the broadest base of support. So each party usually has about 30% of the population that they can count on, which leaves another 40% of the population who identify either independent or only slightly lean in one direction or the other. And so when a party is interested in winning more votes nationally, typically you'll see a move toward the center. But there are different views on how a person or a party or a candidate can capture some of those 40% of voters. And this is really where the argument will be. There are also people in the party who say that it's more important to stand for a principle than it is even to win elections. And this is where you get some of the debates on the Republican side, where there are people who are complaining about Mitt Romney as a candidate or if Chris Christie is going to be a candidate, whether or not those candidates are acceptable for people who want the Republican Party to stand for certain things. And so this is the kind of debate that's going to happen, particularly on the Republican side, going into the next election cycle.
Now, I'm guessing another safe bet is that we're going to be watching the economy quite closely, just like we have been this past year. Now, with the closing of 2013, there did seem to be some positive economic indicators. How important do you think the economy will be in the political scene come 2014?
Yeah, well, it's going to be very important. And I think one of the interesting things about the elections that we're going to see coming up is that we've had a national government, or at least in the presidency, the Democrats in charge. In the state, we've had Republicans in charge. And so there's going to be a competition for who's going to claim the most credit for economic recovery or blame for a slower than expected economic recovery in other areas. I think that the economy is a really important factor. And this is also because people have been looking at the economy as a primary issue, and all of the issues that are related to the economy, job creation and deficits, these are all things that are going to be central to these campaigns.
Now, let's say the economy takes off and it looks like we are on solid ground finally. We have jobs, we have construction, all those things that people look to. What does that mean for the two political parties?
Typically, when the economy is improving, incumbents do well. So if the economy is improving nationally, I think Democrats probably will get more credit for that. And in the state, if the economy improves, Republicans will get more credit for that. And it may or may not have anything to do with policies at either level, or maybe it has somewhat to do with policies at both levels. But any party or person who's in power typically has a reward when the economy does well. And typically, if the economy is doing poorly, the party or representative that is currently in office would get punished.
We're talking right now to political scientist Tim Dale about his predictions for the biggest stories expected in national and state politics in 2014. Coming up, we'll talk about what Tim thinks the top stories will be in Wisconsin for the coming year. And we'd love to hear from you on this, too. What do you think the biggest stories of 2014 will be, and what issues would you like to see the federal government tackle? What do you hope for from Congress? Do you want to see more cooperation, or do you want to see your representatives standing up for what you would like the big issues to be? Do you want to see them be scrappy? And what about the state of Wisconsin? What emerging headlines do you see as the big stories likely to make the news? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And we're picking up our conversation now with political scientist Tim Dale about his predictions for the biggest stories for state and national government in 2014. And we're taking your calls. What do you think the biggest stories of 2014 will be on both the national stage and the Wisconsin stage? And what do you think will emerge as we move out of some big areas of contention? We had the government shutdown. We had a lot of partisan gridlock going on. And, of course, we have the gubernatorial race coming up in Wisconsin. What do you think the big stories will be, and what would you like them to be? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. Now, earlier we talked about the big stories you were expecting on the national stage. Now, let's talk explicitly here about Wisconsin in 2014. What big stories do you see emerging here?
Well, in Wisconsin, the big headline is going to be the governor's race, as you just mentioned. And not only is it going to have attention in the state, but also outside of the state. Scott Walker is a notable governor in being one of the Republicans who took over a state back 4 years ago, and of course we had the recall attempt, controversies involving state policies, state budgets. So in this year we are going to get, while the recall was a kind of referendum on Walker's term, we have the first full referendum on Walker's leadership. And with the Republicans in control of the state legislature, Unlike the national government, where we have a divided government, we do not have that situation in the state. And so the Republicans are going to be treating this election and the Democrats as a question about the Walker governorship and also the state legislature. So that really will be the story of 2014.
Is this a big wild card? You talked about the recall elections. Is it fair to say that the recall election was also a referendum on recall elections?
Yeah, what we saw with the recall election is that there were clearly people who supported Walker and clearly people who didn't like what Walker had done. But the exit poll showed that some of the people who voted for Walker were people who did not like the idea of a recall election. That is, that there are people who believe that Walker should be allowed to fulfill an entire term in office and then be held accountable for that term. And so I think you're right. I think part of the reason that the recall was so successful and though so many votes were in Walker's column is because the idea of a recall did not sit well with some people. And so with the election of 2014, we're going to get the, so to speak, real election for governor. And without the politics of the recall itself, it'll be a more clear picture and depiction of what voters think about Walker as governor, as opposed to just an opinion about a recall.
How much national attention do you think the election's going to get?
Well, I think that there will be quite a bit of national attention for a couple of reasons. The first is that Walker represents a Republican governor who took over a state, and this has happened in other states around the country. And really one of the best examples, most clear examples of policies being put into place that the Republicans really think are the best policies for state budgeting, policy priorities. And so I think that there's a policy reason why a lot of people will be looking at Wisconsin. Do these policies work? Do voters think that they'll work? The other reason that a lot of people will be watching is because of the personalities who are involved, in particular Scott Walker, who by some accounts is interested in running for president. And even if he has not indicated that he's interested, there are some Republicans who are interested in Scott Walker running for president. So I think that there are some policy issues, but also some national implications for the success or failure that Walker might have in the election in 2014, kind of setting the stage for the next 3 years of national politics.
With the gubernatorial race here to egg citizens on, do you think that what will happen is that it will reveal itself that Wisconsin is sort of over the recall elections, over all of the animosity that went on here on both sides? Or do you think that we'll be sort of returned to that same sort of atmosphere again?
Well, I think that we'll return to that atmosphere at least a little bit, because I think if there's one thing that the recall election showed, is that people feel fairly strongly about their policy positions on these issues. And so division, even though it expresses a disagreement and discord, it also shows that people are really invested in politics, really care about the outcome of elections. I'm not sure that we're going to see the protests that we saw around the recall election, but I imagine that we're going to see some pretty strong feelings and some people who have had a chance to think a little bit more about the way that they make arguments publicly, the way that they express their position, and we're going to see some real attempts at trying to convince maybe swing voters that the policies either work or don't work.
Now, we should talk about the Democratic challengers. Mary Burke has already thrown her hand into the ring as a Democratic candidate. What do we need to know about her for 2014?
Well, Burke is the person that many Democrats are considering to be the person who is the apparent challenger to Walker. There are a couple other candidates who may become involved in the race. I think right now the money is going to Burke, and even the money against the Democrats is going against Burke. So they're already very seeing some ads against Burke, some websites that have been designed as attack websites. So I think in Burke, the Democrats think that they have a person who comes from kind of relatively outside of politics, from the business world, who will be able to speak directly to the issues that they think that they might be able to gain some headway against Walker on.
So is it possible that with Mary Burke in place, there won't even be a Democratic primary? Do you see that happening?
It's possible. Right now, other candidates who may be interested are probably looking at the ability to raise money. Typically, if there is a candidate who emerges early as kind of the apparent challenger, it's very difficult to gain support for an opposition candidate. The reason that we might see an opposition candidate, and this is just historically, not necessarily in this situation, is when there are major issues that are dividing a party, and the major issues that may cause one candidate to stand for something that other members of the party don't. I don't think that's the case here. I think the major issue for the Democrats right now is to beat Scott Walker. I don't think there's a lot of division within the party on policy issues. And so that would be a reason that we might predict that there wouldn't be a Democratic challenger. But that being said, I know that there are some Democrats who are considering it, and if there's enough people telling them that they should run, we may see a challenge, even if it's not successful.
And as a final question here, do you think Wisconsin is still suffering from election fatigue, or do you expect a big turnout at the polls?
That one's hard to say, because we really haven't seen the kind of election fervor that we've seen over the last few years in Wisconsin. But I think that there are enough people who care deeply about the issues that I think that we would predict a pretty good turnout in the governor's race. And even with the recall, I think there's a chance that we might see a higher turnout given as much attention as this election is going to garner in 2014.
Okay, well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us, and Happy New Year. Thanks for making time today.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
That was Tim Dale, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse.